Hello, welcome to The Rest is History and welcome to 2024. Happy New Year, Tom.
Happy New Year, Dominic. Happy New Year, everyone. Hope you all had a good one.
A good one.
Without any fear.
Oh, very good. Yeah. So, Tom, wonderful Christmas for you, was it?
Well, as people know, we are actually recording this on the 18th of December, so...
Oh, come on, Tom. Play the game. Play the game.
Looking into my crystal ball, yes, it was brilliant. I had a wonderful Christmas. Our pipes didn't burst.
Oh, that's good. That's wonderful news.
The heating didn't go on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
My turkey wasn't stolen from the back of my car. Yeah. It was all brilliant.
My single favorite Christmas story. So we're going to try and get through loads of questions, or at least some questions today. So Tom, I think we should just kick off with a question we've had on the Discord from our listeners. And this is from AMJ, who I don't think has asked a question before. And AMJ says, who was the biggest lad, Byron or Shelley?
Right. Well, there is no doubt as to this at all. It's definitely Byron, who will be the subject of a series in April, marking the 200th anniversary of his death. So Shelley at school, huge bands of fellow pupils would roam the streets, kind of hunting him down.
They would.
They do kind of Shelley hunts.
They'd be chanting, the Shelley, the Shelley, the Shelley, and pursuing him with weapons and stuff, weren't they?
So, I mean, Shelley was very brave, but he wasn't a lad. He was a vegetarian. I don't think you can be a lad if you're a vegetarian, can you?
No. Hitler was a vegetarian, Tom. My favourite historical fact.
He definitely wasn't a lad. But Byron, I mean, Byron was the essence of a lad. Byron essentially was to lads what Napoleon was to European conquest. And they were kind of very similarly totemic figures of the Romantic period.
Yeah.
So definitely Byron.
Definitely Byron. Okay.
Elizabeth Fiery Babel, asking both of us, but I'm going to ask you, Dominic.
Yeah.
What's your favourite episode or series of 2023?
Ooh.
So that's a retrospective question.
Yeah, I'm just looking through the list now. I mean, it's unbelievable how many episodes we did. It actually is mind-boggling. I look back and I think, God, was this only last year? But if I think I had to choose one, or I choose one series, what I'll always remember very fondly is going to Ireland and doing the Irish episodes. Because we were quite, I wouldn't say anxious, but we spent a lot of time talking about exactly how we'd do them, what guests, you know, how it would work, what tone to adopt, all of that kind of thing. You know, we did put some thought into it. And we were just unbelievably fortunate that we got to do it at the GPO. So this kind of, you know, legendary site in kind of Irish nationalist history, the place where the Easter Rising happened. But we were just incredibly lucky to have Professor Paul Rouse as a guest. And we didn't quite know how Paul would be, did we? I remember we walked up to the GPO where Paul was going to meet us. And he sort of met us in a very jolly way and started showing us around. And I thought, if he keeps this tone up, it's going to be perfect. And then he started doing the episodes and it was great. And he was a brilliant host.
It was three episodes he recorded, wasn't it?
Yeah. He did three episodes basically in one go. Mm. We had a break for tea or something, did we? For a cup of tea halfway through. And then you and I went off to the Doyle to meet some Irish politicians.
And meanwhile, Theo had gone to the pub.
Theo went to the pub with Paul.
With Paul.
Yeah.
And was looking a little bit worse for the wear by the time we joined him. And he was still there at 11 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah. Well, there's one person at the Rest of the History party, of course, Tom, who notoriously went home for a nap halfway through the afternoon.
I had to go and check my emails.
Yeah, because he didn't fancy all the drinking.
But Dominic, also not to forget Dan Jackson's contribution as well, which was brilliant.
Yeah, it was.
So that was the third episode.
Yeah.
So we were just very, very lucky in having two amazing guests for that series.
Yeah.
My choice would be, I think, the Aztecs, which I thought was an amazing story. I mean, we said it repeatedly throughout the series. I think the single most extraordinary narrative in world history.
Yeah, it's a good story.
I really, really enjoyed doing those episodes.
I have to admit, I really enjoy doing the long narratives. I know listeners are, there are some listeners who love them. There are some who say, oh, I don't have time for lots of huge long series or whatever. I've become such a convert in the last sort of 10 or 20 years to the idea of narrative as an analytical tool. Because I think so many academic historians are so anxious about narrative. They hate narrative. They think it's dumbing down. You know, it's not what you should be doing. And I think narrative is so important because I think you can only understand why things happen when you understand what is happening over what time period, in what sequence. And I felt like, you know, just talking through that story, I understood it better at the end of doing that than I did before we started.
You do. Because writing a narrative It imposes an obligation to make sense of the scattered fragments of evidence and try and construct it in such a way that it makes sense as a narrative.
Yeah.
And I think unless you do that, you miss out important things, because the events that I always think of that I've written about in this context is the beginnings of Islam.
Yeah.
That if you are not writing a narrative of it, how do you explain where the Quran comes from?
Yeah.
You have to have an explanation for it. And you can say, well, it comes from God, but in which case you're writing quite a different kind of history.
Yeah, you are.
To the kind of history that you'd set out to write, perhaps, as a non-Muslim.
Yeah.
So that would be the classic example for me.
But talking about the narrative thing reminds me of something else that came up in 2023. The Guardian columnist and BBC presenter and former football presenter, Adrian Childs, who is a very keen listener to The Rest is History, wrote a column in The Guardian where he was talking about the use of the historical present, which he sometimes finds jarring. And the historical present is, you know, so Cortes arrives, he looks around, he decides to do this. You know, everything's in the present tense. And actually the Aztecs, like all our narrative series, I think we did it pretty much entirely in the present tense. I think that is actually a very useful tool as well.
Yeah.
Placing you in the moment, they don't know what you know.
Yeah.
You know, the future remains to be written kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely. I have no problem with it at all. Right. So those are our selections. Do let us know what yours were, if you had a favorite one. Cucumber slice. Is there realistically any undiscovered history remaining, and history in inverted commas there, that if uncovered would have a meaningful impact on our everyday lives?
No. Very little history has any meaningful impact on our everyday lives. That's a shocking thing for a historian to say. But, you know, imagine people discovered Cleopatra's tomb. So what? Not going to affect the lives of people in Alexandria.
But to play devil's advocate,
yeah,
an example of someone discovering, in inverted commas, history that has had an impact on our lives would be Vladimir Putin, looking at the history of Kiev or whatever.
Yeah.
The beginnings of Russia, the beginnings of what's now Ukraine.
Yeah.
And realizing that this needs to be acted on.
Yeah. If he finds the tombs of Askold and Deer, the founders of Kiev, you think that could dramatically change the fortunes of the war?
I mean, the thing is about discovering history is that actually the discovering of history has repeatedly had quite an impact. So whether it's, you know, Protestants discovering the fact that actually the claims of the papacy are invalid, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I don't think that's what Cucumber Slice is asking. You're talking about the rewriting of history.
Well, he's got history in inverted commas.
Yeah, but I think Cucumber Slice is thinking
Archaeology.
Personally, I'm just guessing.
Or a document.
And I totally agree with you. Although it's an interesting question about whether the rewriting of history happens first or afterwards.
Yeah, of course.
But the two go hand in hand,
yes,
don't they?
Of course. It can be a bit of both.
So the nationalist rewriting of history in the late 19th century, you know, that sense of history, Hitler has a very profound sense of history. You know, he really thinks about history a lot. He reads history books.
He does.
He cares about history. And the stuff that he's reading influences Nazism.
Yeah, absolutely. We haven't recorded it yet, but I suspect that we will be discussing that as part of our series on the Nazis in power.
Yeah.
Son of Tawanda, who's had this question for a while. How do the two of you read? Does it depend on the situation, reading for pleasure or reviewing a book or preparing for a podcast? It's all three, isn't it?
Yeah, they're the three categories. So reading for pleasure, I would always be reading something different for pleasure from what I'm doing for work. Reviewing a book is different still. That's work.
That really is work. You've got to concentrate in a different way. It's about concentration, isn't it? I mean, you have to concentrate on all three.
Yeah.
If you're reading a novel, you need to concentrate on the plot or whatever, because otherwise you're not going to work out what's going on. If you're reviewing, you need to make notes. You need to think, how am I going to craft this into a review?
Yeah.
And if you're preparing for a podcast, it's quite a specific mode of concentration that has been refined over the past 3 years.
Yeah.
I would say that I'm probably better at sucking the blood out.
Right.
Than I would have been when we began.
I've been thinking about this in recent weeks, actually. I mean, we read totally differently when we started the podcast because the podcast was different. So when we did the French Revolution episode, the one we always bring up, I read a little bit about the French Revolution the night before to remind myself what happened and to think about some ideas about the French Revolution. But I don't even think I took any notes because I just thought, well, I'm just going to be talking to Tom for 45 minutes. Now, when we do our French Revolution series in the summer, I mean, I dread to think how many pages of notes I'll have.
I do as well.
Because now we are much more, on the podcast, we spend more time telling stories than we did 3 years ago, don't we? And to do that, you need to have very detailed notes to be able to say, well, You know, Tom, when you're talking to us about the Nuremberg rallies, you tell us who Leni Riefenstahl was, you tell us about Triumph of the Will, you have your notes, and you've obviously read in a very disciplined and focused way to get the notes.
I wonder, and I'd be interested to hear what people think about this, is the focus too tight? Should we perhaps leave a little bit more space for the waffle that used to characterise?
He loves the waffle. He loves the waffle.
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
I have a horror of waffle, Tom.
You don't. You're very good at it. What are you doing now?
I always feel that we're walking over a tightrope and there's an abyss of waffle, you know, waiting up to swallow us.
Yeah, but it's not a tightrope. It's like those rope bridges that the
Indian porters would fall off in the Andes.
Yes.
Yeah.
When going off to El Dorado.
Yeah.
Obviously with a risk that you slip and fall.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we could give ourselves a bit of room to breathe, perhaps.
My instincts are very Greg Grindian.
Well,
and I live in fear of abstract nouns, as you know. So
well, there are going to be a lot of abstract nouns coming up.
All right. I'm going to ask you a question from Al the King. When do you think history starts and ends, Tom? So first of all, when does prehistory and myth end? And secondly, when does current affairs start? So when's the first and last moment in history for you?
There are all kinds of possible answers that could be given to that.
Oh, that's an evasive answer.
No, it's not. It's not, because history has many different shades of meaning.
Sure.
So history, I mean, the classic definition of it is that it's written. So without writing, you can't have history.
Yeah.
But we've done the Neanderthals.
Yeah.
For instance, we've done Stonehenge. We've done
dinosaurs.
We have done prehistory.
Yeah.
So I think prehistory can be folded into history, into the study of history.
Okay.
When we did our episodes with Carl Harper on disease.
Yes.
The impact that disease has had on humans.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of that was in the period before settlement and before the invention of writing. You could also say that history begins when people are looking back to the past and trying to make sense of it in written form.
Mm-hmm.
Not as myth, not as poetry, not as drama, not as whatever.
Yeah.
So beginning with Herodotus. But it would be insane to say that, you know, the study of Babylon or ancient Egypt isn't history.
Yeah.
So I think that there isn't a precise answer to that.
Yeah.
I mean, there isn't a rule on this. It's not like there's a kind of consortium of historians who are drawing up rubric for this.
Yeah.
What I would say is that in antiquity, the assumption was that all history was pretty much contemporary history, and that only those who had lived through events could describe it, and that anything else
really
was essentially inadequate as history.
Oh, that's funny.
So Caesar's commentaries would be viewed as history. I mean, they're simultaneously news reports from the front, but he's writing it as history because he's the person who's been on the scene and seen it. So therefore, he's the best qualified to write it.
Tacitus, Suetonius, how long are they living after the events they're writing about?
Suetonius, he is drawing on records. And Tacitus, likewise, is very, very self-consciously drawing on historical records. So there you can see the process by which kind of the classical understanding, the Thucydidean understanding of history, because Thucydides, of course, you know, he writes his history of the Peloponnesian War as he sees it as an Athenian, although a Spartan, doubtless, if they'd written history, would call it the Athenian War, but he had been a participant in it. Indeed, he'd been sent into exile for screwing up a campaign, and he writes about that campaign. But of course, people want to write about periods that they don't know, and so then you start getting
a
sense of history that is perhaps closer to ours. But that's by way of saying that you could write a history that goes up to this year. I don't see there's any rule against that.
Yeah, of course you could. People don't tend to, though.
Because they're afraid that it's too early to tell.
Well, they want a little bit of perspective.
Yeah.
So I get asked this question a lot because people will say, golly, the 1980s, is that history or whatever? I think that the general trend, I would say, because people have always written books about very recent history. I mean, going back 150 years or so, people have written books.
But in the bookshop now, it would be under politics, wouldn't it? Or current affairs or...
Yes. If you want to be in the history section, I would say you're normally looking about 30 or 40 years ago. So there are books now just beginning to be written about the 1990s, sort of synoptic histories of the 90s.
There were books that came out about 9/11.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Can't remember what it was called.
The Looming Tower or the Something Tower. Yeah.
And Jason Burke wrote The 9/11 Wars, which was a history of Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah.
And I would guess they would be categorized as history, but I'd be interested to know in the bookshop whether they appeared in history. Probably the history of the Middle East, I'd have thought, or something like that.
More Middle Eastern politics. So, I mean, I was motivated to write my own histories of post-war Britain by the fact that there were already history books about America in the same period. Really, 60s America. That was in the 1990s. So again, 30 years. I think you've got enough distance to say, you know, all the principals' careers have ended. So you know how the story ends for all the characters you're writing about, how the story ends for Nixon, for the Kennedys, for LBJ, whatever, and how events played out and what then happened to the generation that followed them. I think you need that generation, a 30-year, 40-year period. You know, you can write about Margaret Thatcher now, I think, with a degree of distance, but you couldn't have done that in the 1990s, could you, Tom?
There's also, so Hugo Young,
yeah,
who was a Guardian columnist,
yeah,
wrote a history about Britain's relationship with the EU.
Yeah, This Blessed Plot.
Which now, of course, would seem completely out of date.
Yeah.
Because it's been upended by Brexit.
Yeah.
Which is an eventuality that he didn't foresee.
Yeah, exactly. Totally right.
And so I guess the risk with writing history that is too close to the events is that you run the risk of having your entire structuring argument being torpedoed by some sudden drastic...
Well, Tom, I'm looking at Never Had It So Good, the first book that I wrote in my post-war sequence. I would rewrite the chapter in that about Britain and Europe.
Right.
If I were writing that today. Because I know that the story ended differently. Even though nothing I wrote was wrong.
The tone.
I just think the weight that I would give to the tone, the different sections.
And also the sense of irony.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be writing it now with a sense of irony that this was all going to end in tears. Now, I suppose if you're a sort of Arrested Politics listener, you will say, but will it all end in tears?
Well, quite. So likewise, I mean, a history of Britain's relationship with Europe that was written now would absolutely run the risk of being upended by something that might happen in,
of course,
2040 or whatever.
I mean, that's the nature of writing history though, isn't it?
Well, it's less of a risk, I think, if you're writing about, I don't know, Luther.
This comes up quite often on the Discord or in people's questions. I always think, maybe you'll say this is unduly fatalistic, Tom, I think the best assumption you should have when you're writing a history book is that you've got, if you're lucky, 20 years, 30 years, maybe, if you're really lucky, and your book will then be superseded. Because it won't be the book that the generation 30 years hence wants to read about that subject, that reflects their own interests, what they see in it. You know, if you're really lucky, you'll be Stephen Runciman's History of the Crusades, and people read it as a classic of its time.
Well, it's a literary classic.
Yeah, a literary classic, exactly.
Which is why people read Gibbon.
Yeah. But Tom, when we're researching a subject for The Rest is History, how many of the books that we read on that given subject were published in the last 10 or 20 years? 90% of them, I would say.
It depends how obscure the subject is.
If it's a really obscure subject, it might be a book from 1973. But when we did our reading on the Nazis, we were reading books published in the last 20 years or so, by and large, weren't we?
Well, I read a book on the Nuremberg rallies. It was published in, I think, 1963.
Is that the Grunberg one?
Mm.
But by and large, like the Richard Evans book.
I absolutely take your point.
I'm guessing the Richard Evans books, which are brilliant, have got what, 25 years?
Yeah, probably.
And then somebody else will write some different book on the Third Reich. And it won't be that the Evans books were wrong or bad or deficient in any way. It will just be...
they're off their time.
They answer the questions that you and I want answered. But, you know, our children or grandchildren want different questions answered.
Well, I mean, it may be that there's more up-to-date research in archives or whatever, but also new paradigms will have come in.
Exactly.
That
exactly.
The scholar needs to respond to.
That's exactly it, isn't it?
I think I mentioned last week that I was reading Francis Young's book, Twilight of the Godlings,
which
is basically about how elves and fairies and dwarves and things came to be part of British folklore. And that's really fascinating because, of course, the material there is so slight. It's like a kind of haze of mist on the edges of what people have written about contemporaries, that the paradigms that are applied to that are absolutely of their time.
Right.
You know, whether it's kind of feminist perspectives from the 1960s or Wicca perspectives from the 1990s, or you can imagine the kind of perspectives that are being brought in the 1930s. I mean, they are so of their time.
Yeah. But if you think about an episode that we did last year, one of the most celebrated episodes we did because people have waited so long for it, which was Viking Sorcery, our episode with Neil Price and his wonderful history of the Vikings. What is it? The Children of Ash and Elm. Just think how dated that book will seem. Yeah. I mean, to us, it seems...
cutting edge.
So cutting edge. And it is really cutting edge. And for precisely that reason, it will seem unbelievably dated to people in 30 or 40 years' time. In a way that actually sometimes narrative histories, you can get away with it as a narrative historian, can't you? Whereas if you're a very trendy historian, au fait with the latest theories, and as you say, the latest paradigms, then it's a very different story.
Okay, one last question. Dominic, and I'm going to ask it because I think we've done an entire podcast on it, so the answer should be very easy to give. And it's from Connor L. When did we start doing memorials for sad things and not just victories? I'm thinking of something like the First World War memorial in every English village. Did the ancients memorialize the people lost in natural disasters, wars, with monumental structures like we do? No, not really.
No, they didn't, did they?
They would maybe memorialize them with, so the dead of Pompeii and Herculaneum, I think, were memorialized by the displays that were put on in the Colosseum, but that was designed to appease their spirits. But am I not right that the idea of memorializing the dead, the glorious war dead,
yeah,
that comes in after the First World War, and it's a response to the scale of the loss in the First World War?
I think pretty much. So I'm actually just looking at what the Bodleian's entry on this says, because it is interesting. So I would have said the First World War or the Boer War. There are Boer War memorials.
But that was a victory.
Yeah.
The thing about the First World War is, of course, the Allies do win, but I don't think it's a victory that's being memorialized, is it? It's the sense of loss.
No, it's suffering. But I think there is a degree of the Boer War memorials. The names are on them. There is a kind of sentimentalization of the dead in the early 1900s that's very much of its time that perhaps wouldn't have been done 30 or 40 years before. But you're absolutely right. It's the First World War that really kicks it off.
So we have an episode on that that I think came out a couple of years ago on Remembrance Day and how the armistice was memorialized and things like that.
I think we made the point there that one of the remarkable things is the idea that every single soldier has, you know, has their grave, and it's, you know, the battlefield, that they're equal in death, all of that. I mean, all that is new. And that comes in with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And Kipling was a big mover in that.
Yes, he is. Yeah. Yeah. Who'd lost his son.
Yeah. And I think that sense of war as trauma, as tragedy, as suffering, that is new, actually.
But I think also one of the reasons why it lives, so why we still have Remembrance Day, and putting that in the context of how the ancients, and indeed people in the Middle Ages and through pretty much right the way up to the 19th century, memorialized the dead, is that that dimension of the supernatural has pretty much gone.
Yeah.
People think that in antiquity, if the dead have not received their funerary rites, then, you know, they will still walk the earth.
Mm.
And obviously attitudes to the dead in Christian Europe are profoundly shaped by theological considerations.
Yeah.
But that's kind of faded. And the First World War is a very Christian war, but it's the last Christian war, really. And already into the 20s and 30s, that confidence that you're dealing with something that might be more than just the kind of the squandering of life and the total extinction of those who died.
Yeah.
Is kind of bedding down, isn't it?
Well, here's an interesting thing. So in France, after the First World War, they had a couple of memorials which actually condemned war itself. So this very famous one is basically Gentil Pigerol. And there they had the names of the fallen, and they had an orphan in bronze who's pointing to an inscription that says, "Let war be damned, cursed be war." And there was an army camp nearby, and the soldiers were ordered for decades that when they walked past this memorial, they should avert their eyes. They shouldn't look at it because it was disgraceful. The village put this up, and it was seen as insulting the glory of France, all of that kind of thing. And that idea about war being wrong and the suffering being something to, you know, you're not, oh, well, we lost, you know, a regrettable necessity. But the whole experience.
Well, yeah. And I think, isn't there, I mean, a sense also in the memorialization of the Great War, a sense that it is a war to end all wars. That's part of what gives it its power.
Yeah, I think so. The memorials are meant to be a punctuation point, aren't they?
Yeah.
And a reminder, never again.
Yeah.
People never said never again after the Napoleonic Wars.
No.
They said, if we have to have a rematch, yeah, great, bring it on.
Okay, well.
It's a really interesting topic, the memorialization of war.
Yeah.
The Commonwealth War Graves Commission. It's absolutely fascinating. They're finding bodies and putting up new graves all the time, and it's really, really interesting. And they invite the family over to Flanders or whatever. It really makes you think about the way we remember the world wars, but also any war. Anyway.
Well, we must stop there. Wishing you all the best for the year as it stretches ahead of us.
Yes.
And lots of stuff to come.
Such fun things to come. Carthage, Tom.
Yeah. Canterbury Tales.
Canterbury Tales.
Man in the Iron Mask.
Yeah. Borgias at some point.
Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Peter the Great at some point. Titanic. Jack the Ripper. Bonnie Prince Charlie, as you say. The First World War. The French Revolution. Tons and tons of fun things.
A lot of biggies there.
Yeah. Lots to look forward to.
So looking forward to 2024. Bye-bye.
Yeah, happy 2024, everybody. Bye-bye.